It's my great pleasure today to introduce our first speaker, whom I strongly suspect hardly needs introducing to many of you, and that is Carter Hayward. Carter Hayward was first cast into the national spotlight in 1974 as one of the first women ordained as a priest in the Episcopalian Church. She received her Master's of Divinity and PhD at Union Theological Seminary in New York, and has also done graduate and postgraduate study at Columbia University. She is currently a professor of theology at Episcopal Divinity School, at one of our neighboring institutions north of the Charles. Carter is well known for her prophetic critique of sexism and heterosexism in our cultural and religious traditions. She has two new books coming out just next week, I believe. One entitled Touching Our Strength, The Erotic as Power and the Love of God, to be published by Harper & Row. And the next, Speaking of Christ, A Lesbian Feminist Voice, being published by Pilgrim Press. Please welcome with me Carter Hayward.
Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer and Margaret, and all of you who have helped put this remarkable event together. I am already just delighted beyond words by the sisters whom I have seen again at supper, however briefly, and on the way in here, and a few brothers too that I recognize from old times, and I'm glad that we are going to be able to do this work together. And I would underscore what Margaret said about our hope that this can be somehow a collaborative effort. I want to also just say that I'm especially pleased to be going first so that I can sit back and enjoy the rest with my old friend and longtime compañera in the struggle, Barbara Gerlach, who was in seminary with me. We were MDiv students at the same time at Union back in what feels like the last life now. But Barbara was reminding me at supper, we were also in the first consciousness-raising group there at Union back in the early 70s, along with Linda Clark, who is also one of the planners back here. And I think Barbara's going to tell you more about that consciousness-raising group. Anyhow, it's a special privilege and honor to be here. And I also want to say that I just went right before I came in here to see Barbara's paintings and drawings, which I hope some of you at least have been able to see already, and that all of you will see tonight or tomorrow. I feel almost a little profane and blasphemous getting up here to talk, having just seen and experienced the courage and the power in the suffering and in the redemption in those paintings and drawings. So, thank you. Okay, what I'm going to be doing now for about 15 or 20 minutes is rushing right on through a much longer paper, which maybe some of you have been able to read by now. It's a rough draft of something I'm working on and began working on for this conference. And rather than summarizing it, I'm going to actually read from it and hope that it holds together as I do. And if not, I trust you will tell me, and we'll take it from there. So bear with me as I sort of jump around in it, but just to get the juices flowing here a little bit. The title of what I'm doing here is Stretching the Boundaries, Encouraging Christology. And let me just say, I'm aware that not everybody in this room is Christian, that some of you are post-Christian, maybe some of you were never Christian, and I celebrate that and hope that this, what I'm doing, what we're doing here, will somehow be able to be engaged with meaningfully and not oppressively, and that also can be part of our conversation, some of the dynamics that this may help generate. I begin on the assumption that we are in trouble. A need for help is something we have in common amid our significant differences. This need for liberation of some sort from some source moves us toward knowing deep in our body selves a universal motif in religion, the yearning for a multi-layered freedom from oppression, hunger, cruelty, pain, loneliness, and fear. We don't have to be Christian to experience the need for redemption, and we don't have to be Christian to be saved from sin, liberated from oppression, grounded in a peace which passes our understanding, yet is not alien to our humanness. I speak here not only as a theologian, but as a woman of faith and doubt, a white Southern lesbian who, whether in folly or wisdom, fear or courage, or perhaps a little of all of the above, continues to identify herself as Christian. So my words are best intelligible as rooted in an ongoing faith struggle and celebration. It's in that spirit that I note that we are in trouble together with God. As we cry out for help, so too does the wellspring of our liberation, the power of love in history, spill over with desire for us to draw deeply from her presence, and in so doing, to be filled with her capacity to befriend one another and the world. In this way, we are sisters and brothers, mothers and daughters, fathers and sons, friends and lovers and soulmates of the sacred spirit herself. Redemption is not God's way of tidying up messy places in history or covering up ugly moments of our life together or our lives as individuals. Neither divinity nor humanity can redeem situations or events like slavery, the Holocaust, or violent, abusive acts against powerless people and other creatures. But redemption is not about saving situations or justifying oppression or abuse. Redemption is about saving people, saving other creatures, and saving the earth. It is also about liberating the sacred power of lovemaking and justice-making from bondage to such human forces as fear. The need for redemption is the context in which Christians historically have done Christology as a way of imaging redemption. Christology has been the lens through which Christians have examined the redemptive character of Jesus' relationship to his brother and sister humans and to his Abba, Father, God. The purpose of Christological study traditionally has been to secure Christian faith in Jesus as the Christ, the Messiah, the Anointed One, the Redeemer, the one through whom redemption is possible. My presentation, however, is not focused on Jesus' role in redemption. I do not mean by this to ignore, trivialize, or condemn ways in which Jesus is significant for most Christians and for many others as well. The Jesus story, as well as the mystical presence of Jesus here and now, is important to my own faith commitments. But I believe increasingly that in attempting to monopolize the redemptive work of God in one person, Jesus, and subsequently in one religion, Christianity, the church got it wrong. Tonight, I want to think Christologically as a way of imaging how we live together in trouble so as to participate in redemption. And what I'm doing here, I maybe ought not to do, but I need to, time being important, so that we can hear from everyone. I'm jumping right over 13 Christological theses that I have suggested in the book that Jennifer mentioned, Speaking of Christ. They're also here in this paper. And I'm going to be drawing more fully on one of them in the rest of the paper. But I would encourage you, if you can, tonight to look at the theses. I don't mean in this very moment, but tonight, if you've got the paper, or tomorrow, so that it can be part of the conversation. And these theses actually came out of a class that I taught several years ago in Christology at the Episcopal Divinity School, and they really were shaped with students and others as we began to look at what it would mean to do Christology from a feminist liberation perspective. I agree with Mary Daly that among theologians, methodology often becomes methodolatry. Discourse about how we make theological claims easily can obscure the claims themselves. The only way not to get lost in vast and ponderous mazes of theological obscurity is to work on the basis of what actually matters to us in our daily lives. As a theological endeavor, Christology matters only insofar as it images and sparks redemption in our lives. In this sense, I hope we come to this conference literally to participate with one another in redemption, not just to talk about it or to reflect it in paintings or in these essays, but if we are honest and open together, to share in the redemptive process. Now, as a means into the Christology I'm trying to do here, I want to look at one of the characteristics that I have not told you about, but have written about. Namely, I want to look at the assumption that Christology should emerge at the crossroads of religious spiritual pluralism, global movements for liberation, feminism, and ecological commitments. I will do this by looking at the difference our experiences of fear may make to what we actually believe about redemption, about ourselves, about God, and about Christ. My focus, as I have stated, is not primarily on Jesus, but on us. For several weeks this summer, in preparation for this talk, I wrestled with the question of what experience seems to me most basically to characterize the trouble we're in. I realized, on the one hand, that I could not universalize such a claim, and on the other hand, that in speaking for myself, I would not be a disconnected, isolated monad, but rather would be representing others who are in trouble with me. And not just one other white Christian dyke, not just other feminist theologians, writers, or academics, not just other Southern exiles who share some commitments to working against racism, class elitism, heterosexism, not just other gringas from North Americana, not just other folks struggling with addiction or abuse in our lives. I know that we can speak with the authority of experience only for ourselves. And yet I know that as we do, some connections get made, some common ground uncovered, some dimensions expanded of what it means to be human. Good theology, good Christology, requires us to see that our lives are connected at the root. This is the basis of our humanity and of our capacity to embody and image divinity. This is our ontology. It is the basis of our morality. When we speak honestly for ourselves, our voices ring with intimations of universality. Speaking for myself, I was able after a while to name fear as the basis of how in my body, self, and relationships I experience the trouble we're in. Other experiences connected in my life to fear include shame, loneliness, and the pain associated with physical or emotional woundedness or disease. But none for me is more fundamental than fear. Fear is an embodied response to being alive. It is a response with physical, mental, emotional, political, and spiritual causes and consequences. As a response to oppression and injustice, to violence and abuse, or simply to the ongoing processes of losing and grieving and dying, fear can be liberating and redemptive. Far more often, however, fear is a debilitating, discouraging mechanism that stifles rather than releases among us the spiritual energy to join in the dance of redemption, which is our power to God. My primary thesis is this. In both its classical and its liberal dress, Christology has reflected a largely disempowering experience of fear. And I believe that if we experience fear differently, and this is something we have to learn with one another, if we learn to experience fear differently, we may be able to re-image redemption, Christology, as a means, literally, of encouraging one another to live differently, to live redemptive lives. We are in a world deformed by fear and disconnection, by structures of injustice and oppression, abuse and violation, experiences of pain, loneliness, loss, and grief, and as a means of coping with these experiences, addiction. This, from a liberation perspective, is a primary dimension of our praxis, the intellectual, political, and spiritual workspace in which our faith and our theologies are sculpted. Now, of course, redemption has as much to do with celebrating our connectedness and our justice as with seeking help in our oppressive or violated lives. But the church has not helped us very much in realizing the joy of participation in redemption. We have learned deep within our embodied relational beings that our fear and disconnectedness are signs of our humanness or our creatureliness. We have not learned as well that our power in relation, our daring to struggle for connectedness, our passion for justice are also signs of our humanness. And we therefore have not seen clearly that liberating Christologies, indeed our Christic ways of living in trouble, will have roots in our courage and not simply our fear. Now, from the beginning, Christology has been an effort to cope with the experience of fear. In Christian theology, the most common and classical experiences and theories of redemption, I believe, have been based in, one, a denial of our fear, spiritualization being a form of denial, two, being ashamed of fear and self-contempt and loathing towards those who, in Julia Esquivel's words, threaten us with resurrection, the sign of our shame of fear. And number three, control of our fear. That is, the need to control our fear makes massive efforts to master our fear rather than to experience it. Courage has been historically a Christian virtue of being fearless, of having no fear. In this scheme, redemption has been our release from fear through denial or control. In this salvation process, the experience of fear is an impediment to liberation. In effect, our humanness hinders our spiritualization, and our fear distances us from God, one another, and our true or spiritual selves. In a worldview distorted by our seeking escape from our humanness, literally our fear of our fear, our religion and theologies reflect these distortions. We become a shame-based religious people stuck in our denials of fear and of our needs to control it. Christology becomes and has been for 2,000 years primarily, I suggest, a way of mastering our fear. Jesus becomes an escape hatch from fear, and as such is our Redeemer or our Christ. In relation to other religious traditions, this Jesus becomes the way, the truth, and the life. In relation to women and Eros, he becomes the master through whose redemptive power is in his phallocratic capacity. In the struggles for justice, Jesus becomes an icon of whatever is most safe, that is to say, the status quo, the custodian of ruling men's power over others. In relation to the earth and other earth creatures, Jesus is head of all, Lord of all. In this Christological panorama, Christ invariably becomes synonymous with mastery, maleness, and exclusivity as the locus of spiritual authority. Now, all of this has to do with mastering fear, I believe. From the beginning, however, not all Christology has been so sealed off from a more inclusive salvation possibility. There has been all along a more liberal, or what I would call a liberal Christological impulse. This liberal impulse has been based not as much in a dogmatic denial of fear as in, I suspect, a genuine out-of-touchness with fear. It's as if there's nothing to be afraid of. This rational and/or idealistic way of approaching the world and redemption differs from its more orthodox counterpart, and that it lacks passion at its roots. There's nothing fierce, nothing frightening about Christologies which originate in our liberal sensibilities. In relation to other religious traditions, for example, the liberal Jesus Christ signifies not only tolerance but acceptance. Jesus himself was a brother, a savior, perhaps the savior for Christians, but not one to punish or exclude others. In relation to gender equality, we are simply one in Christ. Similarly, in all struggles for justice and for a sane relationship to the earth, we are one in the spirit. Justice will come as it comes. Change happens. In these processes, be they aesthetic or scientific, Jesus is brotherly, friendly, and an important or not so important historical memory, and Christ becomes synonymous with unity, harmony, and inclusivity. The liberal Christological tendency, in its own way, I believe, is also a means of controlling our fear. Less by denial, more by management. Less through shame, more through reason. This liberal impulse has provided a basis for Christological dissent for much of the 2,000 years of Christian history. It certainly has been germane to the development of most mainline Protestant and Catholic theology in the last several decades. It has helped provide a vision of unity and peace for theologies of liberation, including feminist liberation theologies. But theologies of liberation also challenge the too facile character of salvation history as viewed through liberal lens. Neither the more classical orthodox nor the more liberal experience of fear as a motive for Christology are adequate, I believe. I believe we cannot draw beneficially upon experiences or images of mastery and control for help in our trouble, but I also believe that we cannot derive much honest benefit from liberal visions and images of harmony and unity in the context of outrageous injustice and abuse. And so my question is, can we who are Christian combine the burning passion of or for Jesus Christ with the friendship and inclusive vision of the more liberal Christological sensibilities and still push the boundaries of both in order to re-image Christologies on the basis of courage and joy and radical transformation? Let me say here that I believe the black church in this country and the Comunidades de Base Cristianas, or the base Christian communities in Latin America, already have embodied much of this Christological possibility in the struggle for justice. And I believe also that feminist liberation theologians, womanist theologians, and many lesbian and gay Christians are signaling what has been missing heretofore, even amid other inspired struggles for justice, namely the embracing of women, eros, and especially erotically empowered and empowering women as incarnations of the love of God. Coming from our different social locations and speaking honestly of our experiences, including our fear, we women of different colors, cultures, sexual preferences, and locations in relation to the struggles for justice have a great deal to share Christologically. We have much midwifing to do with one another to give birth to the sacred Christic spirit. So I want to set forth here, really in closing, what I believe an encouraging Christology, radical and passionate, would involve. We would fear oppression and injustice. We would fear abuse and violence. We would fear pain and loneliness and loss and grief and probably death. We might even continue to fear difference and otherness and loss of control and anger. But we would seek ways into and passages through our fear. We would not be ashamed of ourselves, of our fearful, quaking, uncertain body selves, or of our questions and our troubles. We would not be afraid of life, of ourselves or one another. We would be afraid in life of alienation from ourselves and one another. Rather than seeking help primarily from images of a God or Christ who is other than us or above us, we would turn ourselves over into one another's care and be open to experiencing our sacred power in relation with one another, not only among humans, but other creatures as well. Rather than making Jesus into a Christological icon of a Superman not like us, we would allow him to be himself, a human brother, tuned in to the sacred spirit. Rather than needing to be in control of our fear by mastering our feelings, the chaos in our lives, and all that threatens us with resurrection, we would learn with one another's help how simply to let it be. Living this way in trouble, our spirituality would be rooted in an acceptance rather than denial of the reality of our lives, including our fear. Redemption would be a process not of escape, but of transformation, not of control or management, but of letting go. Redemption would be a process not of becoming one, but of relating in our differences and our troubles, and of struggling for justice into and through our conflict, confusion, anger, and pain, struggling together. Letting go does not mean avoiding struggle for right relation. It does not imply disconnection. Letting go means giving in to life, letting ourselves be swept along with those currents of righteousness which flow down like waters in our life together. Letting go means giving up our lives in order to find them. Letting go takes courage. It takes one another's solidarity and presence. Letting go is the essence of redemption. It is the only way we authentically can involve ourselves in struggles for justice and simultaneously experience the peace of God. Encouraging Christology to image this redemption would give us glimpses, I believe, of Jesus not as Christ per se, but as brother, soulmate, whose Christic power is sacred precisely because it is not contained in or limited to one person, then or now. In relation to other religious traditions, such a Christology would empower us to recognize the redemptive character of living in the spirit of justice and joy, regardless of by what, if any, religious name it may be called. Not only would such Christianity have no monopoly on the truth, we would realize that there is much cause for Christians to repent what we have done in the name of Christ. In this context, our Jesus memory, or Christic commitment, would be one of humility. That is to say, we would be calling one another with one another to confess our harm of others, and we would learn to be grounded with others in the same world. That's humility. In relation to women and to gay and lesbian people, we would see that there is a special need for Christian confession and repentance, and for transformation through a spirituality and politic that celebrates strong, erotically empowering women and affirms unalienated, nonviolent, non-abusive sexuality as a sacred gift and resource that needs no higher justification than itself. In this context, Jesus might well be imaged as our co-celebrant, a sensual, playful bearer of eros and passion. In the struggles for justice for all, we would know that Christic power is ours in making mutual, just, right relationship. We would realize that mutuality is a profoundly courageous and revolutionary process of relating in which all participants, nations, races, individuals are respected, taken seriously, and called forth to be themselves in nonviolent, non-abusive ways. We would experience mutuality as relational movement through fear. Such a revolutionary relational struggle would involve ongoing transformation of our values and our understandings of power. We would move away from experiences of mastery and patronization toward the possibility of genuinely mutual participation with one another in these times of fear and trouble. There would be no scenario too global and public or too small and private for this movement and this struggle. In it, our deepest Christic sensibility might well become what D'Ortiazola calls revolutionary patience. For though we could glimpse this radical possibility only through a glass dimly, we would see it and believe in it as the root of our spirituality. In the wellsprings of historical memory, we Christians might notice Jesus and his friends as having made some contribution to this vision of a power transformed by love and justice, and of a love that is stronger than fear. This love would be ours to generate, to cultivate, and to embody together, and we would learn to see that it is also the power of God. Finally, in relation to the earth and the cosmos, an encouraging redemptive process would be one of partnership and mutuality, not domination and mastery. We would realize that we are participants in nature with other natural resources, not always kind or fair or welcome in our interactions. And yet we could establish, from a human perspective, a much more mutually attentive and caring relationship with other creatures in the earth than heretofore most of us have been able to do. We would begin to see that if we accept a relational ontology as the basis of our ethics, we will know that it is natural to struggle against racism and for justice, and that it is just to seek partnership and mutuality with the forces of nature. We would see that our fear of violence and abuse is natural, and that we need not to try to escape or master it. We would see that our fear often of nature, of harsh winters, of droughts, of hurricanes and earthquakes, is also natural and for the most part healthy. Our fear would not be experienced as an embarrassment or as an adversary. It would be rather a sign that together we would learn to recognize and interpret on the basis of a hermeneutic of courage. We would begin to interpret our lives on the basis of this courage, which is to say, a willingness to risk the dubious benefits of mastery and control on behalf of more fully mutual relationships with sisters and brothers, which would indeed give our humanness, the very essence of who we are as sisters and brother earth creatures, their sacred, redemptive shape. I think I will stop there. Thank you.
Our second speaker this evening is Barbara Gerlach, who, as Carter has shared with you already, was also a student at Union at that very exciting time in the early 70s. She is currently an artist in Washington, D.C., who serves as a minister part-time at the First Congregational Church in Washington, D.C. She's an ordained United Church of Christ minister. She has published a book entitled The Things That Make for Peace, which consists of meditations on biblical passages which are illustrated by her own artworks. This evening, she's going to give a brief introduction to her artwork and then present slides of it for us and then have some concluding remarks before we open up for, we have a brief break and then open up for questions. So please welcome with me Barbara Gerlach.
This is a real coming home for me because I lived and worked in Boston for 11 years. And as I look out at your faces, I see very many of my very close friends. My paper is entitled Telling the Truth, Sharing Our Stories Through Art, Dreams, and Imagination. And this is the community where I have chosen to tell the story that I will share here in words, and I share just up the street through my drawings and paintings. The poet Muriel Rukeyser once asked, "What would happen if one woman told the truth about her life? The world would split open." I try to find and tell that truth through my art. I had a dream a few months ago as I was preparing this paper. I was attending a feminist theological conference and had chosen, of all things, a seminar on feminist methodology because two friends were leading it. I hadn't read their book, and I was feeling more and more lost. Finally, I confessed, I have always had trouble with theology written by men, but I'm having trouble with theology by women and feminists, too. It's so abstract. Instead, I found myself looking at the pictures in their books, faces and figures from earliest human history, and feeling a deep connection between those ancient masks and my own art. My way of sharing my story and telling my truth is more visual than verbal. Art is my wit's end experience. What I can't put into words, what my mind can't grasp or actions carry, I search and shape in my paintings and drawings. which then take on lives of their own and tell their own stories. But behind each piece of art is my own story, a story of what caught my eye or stirred my emotion, what I felt or learned as I painted, and the meanings that continue to be revealed over time. I share the story of my art and the stories behind my art, hoping they will evoke your stories of suffering and redemption. What drove me to art was the experience of suffering. In the late 60s, my eyes were opened to suffering and injustice by the civil rights movement and the war in Vietnam. That injustice hit closer to home as I found a way of naming my own struggle through the women's movement and my involvement in it. In the early 70s, as a parish minister, I met the suffering of ordinary people as I visited the sick and buried the dead, not only the old, but newborn babies and teenage victims of car crashes and suicidal depression. My art became a way of searching the face of suffering, and in the words of the Suffering Servant song, becoming more acquainted with grief and sorrow. One day, I was particularly moved by a photograph of a South African woman whose face stared back from me from the morning newspaper. I tore it out and decided to draw what touched me. Afterwards, I wrote this in my journal as I tried to understand what was happening as I drew her face. I have been following with unusual interest the news of the struggle in South Africa, feeling the gathering of forces, the desire for freedom that can no longer be suppressed. Last week, I saw an AP photo of a Soweto woman whose sons had been killed by Zulu tribesmen. I knew I must draw the suffering I saw on her face. Usually my fear about my creativity is that nothing will come. The paralysis that keeps me from picking up a pencil, the fear of the empty page, the meaningless scribble. But today I was fearful of what was coming out of me too. I feel the agony of that woman in me, the power and pain face to face. I feel like I have returned shaken from a holy place. Part of me wants to draw back and hide. We cannot see God's face and live, yet I feel like I have glimpsed God's face in the agony of that woman's face. In the hours and days that followed, I felt like a well of suffering had been opened in me. The words of Blake's poem, Divine Image, haunted me. For mercy has a human heart, pity a human face, and love the human form divine, and peace the human dress. Since then, I have drawn the faces of many people who have stared back at me from the morning paper as a way of searching the suffering of people of different ages and races, different conditions and cultures than my own. I have painted the faces of sorrow and struggle. I have painted the faces of war and hunger. I have painted the faces of the powerful and the victims, and especially the faces of the children who seem as bewildered as I by the suffering around them. I found a photograph of a child survivor of Nagasaki. Then other faces moved me. A Vietnamese girl, a schoolgirl from Soweto, a Pakistani woman grieving the death of Bhutto. Drawing their faces, looking back through their eyes, I became a survivor too. For me, reimagining redemption involves looking deeply at the suffering and injustice the brokenness and incompleteness from which we seek relief and release, recovery and reconciliation. Only when we see what is can we imagine what will bind us up or set us free and move toward deeper healing and wholeness, greater freedom and fulfillment. Is your smile like a nervous tick? Is one of the questions we discussed in my first women's consciousness raising group. Mine was. As women, we are brought up on images like, there was a little girl who had a little curl right in the middle of her forehead. When she was good, she was very, very good. And when she was bad, she was horrid. We are encouraged to be good girls, show our happy faces to the world, and bury our anger and aggression underground. When these unexpressed emotions erupt, we feel horrid, frightened, even crazy. My art has provided me with a way of unmasking the hidden pain and fury. One summer, I did a series of self-portraits, carefully observing my face. At the end of the day, I took the leftover paint on my palette and let loose, entering some dark, unknown place and unearthing an underworld of more inchoate feeling. I call these faces my inner faces, for they have helped me see the range of emotions I harbor within me. Painting them, I understood the second version of Blake's divine image. Cruelty has a human heart, and jealousy a human face, terror the human form divine, and secrecy the human dress. A few years ago, I was driven to paint my inner faces again, depressed by a difficult move and in a frenzy of rage as present losses stirred up losses from the past. I painted to exorcise the fury screaming inside me. Unable to sleep one night, I went up to my studio and painted a large, screaming mouth. Then I got in my car and drove to a deserted park where I gave that mouth sound, screaming and screaming at the top of my lungs. My first interfaces were small and introspective. Quieter meditations on the raw stuff I was made of. These faces were large and monstrous, exploding with hurts and hates dammed up since childhood. My art has been a way to open the emotional floodgates, let my feelings flow more freely, and become more familiar with and less fearful of the full force of my emotions. These interfaces have challenged my inherited images of what it means to be good and bad, and have deepened my understanding of emotional health and wholeness. They have helped me cut a more direct path to my own feelings, freeing me to experience their primal energy, their varieties of expression, and the range of their creative and destructive potential. Like dreams deferred, unexpressed emotions are explosive, but they are equally dangerous when they are turned inward in depression and self-hatred, or in self-defeating or self-destructive behaviors. But what were the events behind these emotions, the source of my sobs and screams? I decided to use my art to excavate these buried experiences. My gaze turned inward to the people who inhabited my imagination, the scenes that haunted my dreams. Like a detective trying to solve the mystery of my own being, I painted every clue, I followed every lead. What I found were babies. Screaming babies, writhing babies, babies trying to comfort themselves. For years, I had painted children, orphans, and refugees, victims, and survivors. Now, through my art and therapy, where I told the stories of the children I painted, I learned that I was a victim and a survivor, too. It is hard to show these pictures and tell the stories behind them. It is harder still to describe the excavation process and the strange images that emerged. I was abused as a child before I had words, at night where dreams and reality merge. I split my experience. Part of me forgot, escaped, went on as if nothing bad had happened. All that remained were flickers of dreams, fragments of memories, flashes of free-floating feeling. To tell the truth, I created double visions, multiple images. A composed adult harboring a screaming child. A smiling child comforting her abused doll. The experience of a baby encapsulated in the body of a growing child or breaking out of my adult body. My truth had many faces. In Things Fall Apart, I found the child who slept, the child who split, the child who tried to hold it together. In Bedtime Story, more people emerged, the waking adult trying to remember, the sleeping adult haunted by dreams, the free spirit who escaped, the victim who was violated, and the babies around the head watching in horror. In her poem, The Images, Adrienne Rich writes, "I can never romanticize language again, never deny its power for disguise, for mystification. But the same could be said for music or any form created. Painted ceilings, beaten gold, worm-warm pietas reorganizing victimization, frescoes translating violence into patterns so powerful and pure, we continually fail to ask, are they true for us?" My art has helped me discover what is true for me. It has transported me into the inner world of childhood, where boundaries are less defined and the self is more diffuse. After years of using photographs of other people as containers for my own suffering, I have found images that are uniquely my own. Yet in telling my truth, I have felt like I am also telling the stories of other women and children, unmasking the violence and revealing the vulnerability of the victims. I tell this story of excavating my abuse because it has taught me much about truth-telling and image-making. My art has broken me open and put me back together again as I have painted my way to help, hope, healing, and found my own images of recovery and redemption. I want to share four images of redemption that have emerged and recurred in my art. First, there are pictures of survivors who express the endurance and persistence of the human spirit, the part of us that refuses to die and give up. These are people who have witnessed life's pain and injustice, look suffering in the face, and make us look at it. They are the solitary figures who have found within themselves the will to live and the capacity to remake their lives. In the words of Adrienne Rich, the passion to make and make again where such unmaking reigns, the refusal to be a victim, we have lived with violence so long. Second, there are pictures of friends. I have always been drawn to the story of Jesus in Gethsemane as he gathers his friends around him and prepares for the suffering ahead. He does not ask them to save him or to suffer in his stead. He only asks them to watch with him and is comforted by their presence. There is much we must suffer and survive alone, but over the years, my solitary survivors have found friends and companions to watch with them, painting funerals in South Africa and in Beirut. I have found the comforting presence of friends. Painting Andrei Sakharov and Yelena Bonner in the Soviet Union and another parting in South Africa, I have found the tender strength of companions. But we need friends not only in crisis, but to encourage us in the recovery process. Some of our deepest experiences of healing and wholeness rise up out of our unconscious through dreams and visions, art and fantasy, prayer and meditation. This next painting is called Mirroring Conversation and grows out of my experience in therapy with a woman who encouraged me to use my imagination to enter the underworld of my unconscious and share the images I found there. As you look at it, let me read the description of a saving event in the life of the poet H.D. Having nearly died in childbirth in 1917, H.D. was taken by a friend to Greece. One day, while sitting with her friend on the island of Corfu, she had a vision or hallucination out of which much of her greatest poetry grew. And there I sat, and there is my friend Briar, who has brought me to Greece. I can now turn to her, though I do not budge an inch or break the sustained crystal gazing at the wall before me. I say to Briar, there have been pictures here. I thought they were shadows at first, but they are light, not shadows. They are quite simple objects, but of course it is very strange. I can break away from them now if I want. It's just a matter of concentrating. What do you think? Shall I stop? Shall I go on? Briar said without hesitation, go on. I had known such extraordinarily gifted and charming people. They had made much of me, or they slighted me, and yet neither praise nor neglect mattered in the face of the gravest issues, life, death. And yet, so oddly, I knew this experience, this writing on the wall before me, could not be shared with anyone except this girl who stood so bravely beside me. This girl had said without hesitation, go on. It was she really who had the detachment and integrity of the Pythoness of Delphi. But it was I, battered and dissociated, who was seeing the pictures and who was reading the writing or granted the inner vision. Or perhaps in some sense we were seeing it together. For without her, admittedly, I could not have gone on. The reimaging process takes enormous courage and concentration. It also takes the encouragement and companionship of friends who say, go on. Third are the pictures of mothers and children. Truth is hard to find. We often recognize it in others long before we see it in ourselves. For years, I painted mothers holding their children, sick children in Nicaragua, poor children in Washington, D.C., without acknowledging the vulnerable child within me or my own need for help and protection. The moment of connection came painting this scene from a funeral in Atlanta, Georgia. Two stories converge in this painting. The first is the public event reported in the paper as Atlanta's children were mysteriously molested and murdered, accompanied by a photograph of a young mother grieving her dead son and being comforted by an older woman. The second is an intensely private moment in my own life when I was able to ask for help from someone older than I, and as an adult, cry out my childhood need and be held and comforted. For me, it was a turning point, very moving and freeing. Sharing the two heavy burdens I had carried since childhood, I felt much lighter and more hopeful. My depression and despair began to break. I knew I was going to get better and returned home saying to myself, I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it. Alice Walker perhaps says it best in her poem Sunday School, circa 1950. Who made you was always the question. The answer was always God. Well, there we stood, 3 feet high, heads bowed, leaning into bosoms. Now I can no longer recall the catechism or brood on the genesis of life. No, I ponder the exchange itself and salvage mostly the leaning. There are times when we need more than friends and companions. We need the very present help and empowering image of someone older or wiser or stronger we can lean on and learn from. That is why many of us have sought out women counselors and mentors, recovered female images of God muted in our own religious traditions, or reclaimed some of the strong and nurturing images of the goddess in ancient religions. Fourth and finally, there are pictures of my learning to comfort and care for myself. Reparenting is a term being used more and more in psychological circles. It is a process by which people who were abandoned or abused, neglected or traumatized as children, go back over those painful experiences and receive from a counselor or friend what they failed to get growing up. In the process of being cared for, they learn to care for themselves. My art is filled with images of my struggles to comfort and care for myself, like this one called Comforting My Doll. Sometimes I have felt overwhelmed by my unmet needs. Sometimes I have wanted to shake and stomp on those babies screaming inside of me. But over time, I have been able to find a stronger, more nurturing self to attend to and care for these inner children and help them grow up. I would like to return to my painting Bedtime Story, because in it, the truth has begun to come together. At the top is the strong, watchful woman holding the many parts of my experience in her arms. Around her head are the babies, the furies within, weeping over what they have seen. In the middle is the sleeping figure, haunted by dreams, but dreaming to remember. On the left is the free spirit who escaped, forgot, went on as if nothing bad had happened. And on the right is the abused child, confused by the mixture of love and violation. I remember seeing Nozaki Shange's For Colored Girls Who Considered Suicide, When the Rainbow is Enough. After the violence, after sharing their stories of victimization, the women gather and find within and among themselves a new sense of self-worth. Slowly, softly, they begin to sing. I found God in myself, and I loved her. I loved her fiercely, fiercely. Something like that has happened to me through my art. In the process of finding and forming my images, searching and shaping my truth, I have grown in self-knowledge and self-love. I have found a more direct and compassionate relationship to myself. Lights, please. I am more interested in the process of image making than in making any claims for the uniqueness or universality of any image of redemption. We must all find our own truths and work out our own salvation in fear and trembling. Our images are different, unique, and always evolving. I hope that seeing my art and hearing my story encourages you in your adventure of image making and truth telling. There is a wonderful description of the woman preacher in Toni Morrison's Beloved. She did not tell them to clean up their lives and to go and sin no more. She did not tell them they were the blessed of the earth, its inheriting meek or its glory-bound poor. She told them that the only grace they could have is the grace they can imagine. The imagination is a powerful channel of grace and healing, a mysterious source of truth and transformation. As women, many of us have given too much of ourselves to caring for others and not enough to exploring and expressing our own creativity. Let me end on a personal note. Showing my art and sharing my story has not been easy. As an artist, putting myself into words has been difficult labor. At times, I have felt like I was taking the raw dough of my experience and pushing it through a spaghetti press and squeezing myself out into long, thin noodles. At other times, I have wrestled with my fear, the fear that Carter spoke about, the fear of sharing my personal images, and the risk of self-revelation. But I have been inspired by Muriel Rukeyser to tell the truth I have found in my art, because I believe that the truth can set us free, and that the most personal is often the most universal. I have also been helped by the practical advice given by the book editor in Muriel Spark's novel, A Far Cry from Kensington. Now it fell to me to give advice to many authors. "You are writing a letter to a friend," was the sort of thing I used to say, "and this is a dear and close friend, real or better invented in your mind like a fixation. Write privately, not publicly. Without fear or timidity, write to the end of your letter, so your true friend will read it over and over and then want more enchanting letters from you. This is my letter with the pictures that illuminate my story."
I hope all of you will take an opportunity to stand up and stretch and think about what questions you might have to ask of Barbara and Carter, or any comments you want to make. We'll come back together in about 5 or 10 minutes. Thank you.
Carter, I wanted to ask you how your language of letting go can avoid being misinterpreted to the surrender language we've always heard.
Everyone heard that? Did people hear the question? Okay, how the language of letting go can avoid being heard as the language of surrender. Oh my. let me just say two things. First of all, I appreciate the question. And I myself have struggled with the same thing. I myself am recovering from addiction and have found the recovery program, 12-step program, enormously useful to me in many ways, and have really resisted some of the language and some of the concepts in it, specifically as a woman and as a feminist. And have found that difficult. And I think that there will be that resistor left in me as long as I live. I hope so. The person who, the one who is trying to say no to oppressive structures. And certainly the expectation that women will surrender our, beginning with our lives, is something that I think I, for one, want to say no to. Same time, I think that I have learned, am learning slowly, and it is a very life-giving learning process, that the
surrendering of myself into the larger pool of humanity, that is to say, of letting myself really be joined with my sisters primarily, but to some extent literally with brothers too, who will stand with me, is an important dimension of my recovery, not only from addiction, but in the most profoundly spiritual dimensions of who I am, and political. So I'm finding myself, I believe, coming into my power and my strength through the experience of learning more and more how to let go, how to do what I can, for example, whatever the project may be, whether it's a particular kind of theological project or political project or relational situation, to do what I can and then realize that's all I can do, and that has to be enough. And that if I genuinely believe in the theology I've been saying something about for a long time in terms of relationality, then there is the business of trusting others to be there too, in some sense, in some form, so that I don't have to do it all alone, that my life is connected to yours and yours to mine, and that somehow we are in this together, and that's what living life is about. And that's what letting go, or turning over, if you will, turning it over into that spirit that connects us is about. And I am not as offended now when I hear that referred to as surrender, though surrender language is not language that I use a lot. And it's still language that I would resist very fiercely in certain contexts.
This may be a follow-up question about the letting go, or it may be more of a comment. Because when I read your paper, I also reacted to the letting go and the fear that letting go would be yet another standard we had to attain in order to be saved. And I think it triggered my old Southern Baptist heritage on that, but it's letting go. And in working with it myself, after reading the paper, what I came to was the letting go of the control of fear and the letting go of the denial of fear. That it was not for me letting go of the fear, even, but that a coming to terms with it and not letting the fear or the negativity of salvation that you talk about eclipse the joy and eclipse the good stuff that that life can be.
Absolutely. Let me say something about letting go from two standpoints. I think on the watch out before you let go side of it, I think as women, when we hear the word, you know, we should lose our lives in order to we have to lose our lives in order to find them, many of us have not had a strong sense to lose. And it's very important to get a strong sense of self, and then out of that, there is some choosing and an ability to let go that is genuine. The second one is that from the standpoint of an artist and as all of us who work with our imagination, that there is a tremendous power in our lives in which images are given. Things emerge, whatever we would call it, the spirit, the unconscious, whatever, and that there really has to be that kind of openness to letting things rise up from within us. And in that sense, it's been incredibly important to me.
I was just going to say two things. First of all, you yourself said beautifully. I certainly can't say it better. In terms of what I understand the letting go to be about, and that Barbara, in her work and in her presentation, illustrates that. It seems to me that that's exactly what we were just witnessing as we watched and listened to Barbara, in terms of, and I think that's what you were just describing, is the letting go. There is a surrendering, if you will, although that may not be language that you would use either, in the discovery of the babies. I mean, at least that's what I experience that as. Extraordinary giving up of or losing control, of refusing to master.
But one that takes courage.
The one that takes enormous courage. I mean, that was when I saw your paintings
in real life, downstairs, upstairs, over there, wherever they are. That was the first thing that I thought of, that these paintings and these drawings have taken enormous courage, incredible courage. To me, it illustrates beautifully the strength in vulnerability, incredible power in making of yourself and inviting us to do the same, to be so vulnerable with one another.
I'm a local pastor, and I was fortunate because I was supposed to be running that machine if the little cord here broke down, and that meant that I had a copy of Barbara's paper, and there's this one statement in there that in the midst of it all could easily be missed that really struck me very deeply, Barbara, and fits very closely to what Carter was saying as well, I believe. And that is that in order to re-image redemption, we must face deeply into pain and suffering. In the parish which I pastor, there is a complete inability to face into pain and suffering. And I don't know whether that's true in other parishes. No? Okay. But the church has around it what some people call art. Lovely pictures of fields of daisies with little children picking daisies and things like that. And on a couple of occasions, I have taken one or two of your pieces of art, Barbara, up to church and hung them. And you know what the responses have been. They have been anything but Christic. They have been that people do not want to face pain and suffering, and yet to me that is profoundly what is wrong with American civil religion, with what is wrong. People are ready to face their own pain sometimes to certain levels, but never someone else's pain. And I, as a feminist pastor, find myself always struggling hard with the image, with Christology, with redemption. When people say, this is, I haven't said my name, so nobody's going to be able to quote me. Whenever someone says redemption, I think green stamps. And I would like to hear both of you speak about the relationship between facing into pain and suffering deeply and a Christiform understanding of God. Because I struggle with that real hard.
Well, let me try. Painting those survivors was a very profound experience for me because it was a real looking into and feeling as my own the pain and suffering of those women and children from Nagasaki and Vietnam and South Africa. What surprised me was, in the process of doing it, that I found strength and I was not overcome and overwhelmed by it. My experience over and over again is that looking into the face of suffering is liberating, and I can't tell you all the reasons why, but it is. We find it's in those dark places that we do find the light and we find the way out. And I don't think we find the way out by going around them. One of the things that has been interesting to me, though, in excavating the abuse, I used to sort of absorb all the suffering. And one of the things that's been very interesting for me in this process is I'm also asking some very different questions. Where is my sense of adventure? What will give me a sense of well-being? What will make me happy? I mean, those aren't words we're supposed to ask, what will make me happy? But I find that in looking at the face of suffering, I'm constantly then, you know, well, what will make it better? Not only for me, but for other people. And there really is this release, and then the capacity to look forward or, you know, re-image, you know, put it back together, the gestalt. I guess that's the word. I have this experience of a new gestalt. I really do think that things fall apart. There's a splitting open, a breaking open, but there is a new gestalt. And it's not immediate, but it does come if you work and wait and paint and write and find your friends.
See, I believe that redemption really is intrinsically relational, that we really cannot do it alone. We can learn a lot about it, I believe, in solitude. That is not to say being alone, and it is, we may be physically separate from one another, but there is a kind of connectedness that is getting made where redemption is happening. I was aware, again, looking at Barbara's work, of how inherently relational art is. I mean, there are those images. So that even when you're painting alone, or even when we are working alone, there is a sense of being connected with something that is in relation to us. That is what it's about. Art, that is what music's about. That is what writing's about. And that is what redemption's about, I believe. And all the more powerfully so in terms of human redemption when you see these many, many faces. I don't know how any of us can teach the kind of redemptive possibility that gets rooted in facing into pain and suffering unless we ourselves are trying to do it. I don't think any pastor can simply preach about it or talk about it. I don't think any teacher can simply teach about it or write about it. I think we have to be doing it. And that is why, for example, the meeting with other people in a 12-step program has been so liberating, despite some of the sexist accretions that get carried along in the program. There's been an incredible kind of liberation in people sharing their stories, and people speaking honestly about their pain and suffering, and beginning to see, as in the faces of the women and the children we were seeing on the screen, to be able to see in the faces and in the lives of people sitting around a table with you, and to hear stories of pain and struggle, and be able to hear the transformation as these stories become increasingly stories of celebration and excitement and joy, not in the suffering. This is not a masochistic experience, but in the discovery that we are together in the suffering, and that together we are coming out of that in some new ways. But not leaving suffering behind. I think this is a fallacy of any kind of liberation movement. It's not that we somehow move beyond suffering or move beyond fear. It's that we are learning more and more how together to experience this with one another forever. And that togetherness and the learning to do it with one another really is the redemptive key, I do believe. So I certainly, no more than anyone here, I'm sure, has any kind of magical words about how this kind of thing happens, but I think we have to be doing it together, and we have to be living it to teach it with any kind of credibility. And yet we're not living it perfectly, obviously, and that's not the point either. And that's a hard one to miss, I mean, hard one to get too.
Nothing to hide, so I will say I'm Renata Rose, and I'm a pastor of the United Church of Christ in Honolulu. I would like to affirm what Barbara said about you have to come and see and face the pain. I have been in the past year twice in the Philippines, and I know many of you here in this room have been in Nicaragua, and it's probably very similar in the base Christian communities. When you live with the poorest of the poor, and they experience just by your simple presence and your interest in them, they feel that you are in solidarity. That's what I would call is redemption, to be in solidarity with pain and suffering. And I found that very liberating. And although I had never been in the squatters of Manila, sleeping with eight people in a room with rats and cockroaches, things like that, that would usually put me in terrible fear, I was able to kind of let go this fear just by the joy of seeing how poor people can celebrate life under the worst of circumstances. So I offer this as an experience of redemption, and I can all invite you to go and see.
Thank you.
My name is Janet Conway. I'm a graduate theology student from Canada. I want to just comment on this connection between the personal and the political that we're talking about, because I think that's what it is we're talking about. In my own experience in excavating the suffering of my own childhood, I think what Barbara just said about in the suffering, that's where you discover the light. It's in that the confrontation with the darkness, the profound darkness, that I came to know in the guts of my guts and the bones of my bones, that the source of life is real, and whatever it was that engenders life in us is a real presence. And that despite the deep pain that connects us and that we share, the source of life is bigger than that. And I think that entering into that experience of suffering is what grounds my and our solidarity with suffering people. And it also grounds my hope, and it's what sustains me, I think, in our political struggles. It's knowing in the bones of my bones that death is not the end, that death is not the last word, and that the darkness is not the last word. And I think that when we know that in our own personal, very intensely personal experience of death, dying and rising, whatever language we put on that, that we enter into the struggles of the poor and the suffering. And bringing that conviction that life will prevail. Mm-hmm.